Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight for what is our last function for the year. It's a busy time, so I'm grateful that you could find your time to get along to hear Dr. Martin Parkinson, who's making his first address to the Sydney Institute. Dr. Parkinson was educated at Adelaide University, at the Australian National University, and at Princeton. He's had a distinguished career in the Australian Public Service, working in Treasury, Prime Minister and Cabinet, and then as Secretary of the Department of Climate Change, and more recently as Secretary to the Treasury since earlier this year. And we're very grateful that Dr. Parkinson could find time to come and speak for us in this busy time in his calendar. And his topic tonight is A Year in Retrospect, A Decade in Prospect. Martin Parkinson, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Gerard, for those warm welcoming comments. And thank you, everybody, for the opportunity to be here with you tonight. Sydney Institute is an amazing institution. If we didn't have it, we probably couldn't reinvent it. So Gerard and Anne, keep up the good work for a lot longer still. With 2011 rapidly coming to an end, I thought I might take stock of what has happened over the year, both globally and domestically, and muse a little about what lies in store for the year and years ahead. So we start with a year in retrospect. Undoubtedly, 2011 has been a tumultuous year. Were I to have been standing here a year ago, I probably would have said something along the lines of this slide. In fact, a barrage of events, either unanticipated or occurring more rapidly than expected, has battered both the global and Australian economies. Who would have thought, standing here this time last year, that we were shortly to see a series of tremendous and devastating natural disasters? Floods and cyclones in Australia, the triple calamity of an earthquake, in tsunami and nuclear accident in Japan, and a second devastating earthquake in New Zealand. These natural disasters have wreaked immense damage on people and communities in all of these regions. And they've also had significant implications for the Australian economy. The deadly floods in Queensland saw the tragic loss of 35 of our fellow citizens, and along with Cyclone Yasi, disrupted countless other lives with the loss of houses, jobs and community infrastructure. The floods and the cyclones disrupted coal production and coal exports, from which we've still not yet recovered, while agricultural production was also hit hard, albeit temporarily. But being hit hard, it did result in very significant increases in product prices and, for a while, headline inflation. The events in Japan, a key export market for our commodities, impacted on the closely integrated global supply chains for vehicles and high-end manufactured goods. Indeed, the loss of production in Japan was a key contributing factor to a 12% plunge in motor vehicle production motor vehicle sales over the period April to June of this year, with similar impacts being seen in Australia, clearly a sign of the extent to which globalisation is thoroughly embedded. Combined, these natural disasters subtracted around 0.75% from Australia's growth in 2010-11. They also meant the Australian economy, and to some extent the global economy, entered 2011 on a less stable footing than might have been implied if I'd been speaking in December, though the global and domestic outlooks were still predominantly positive. This stability in the global outlook has been questioned a number of times this year, including in part by the major geopolitical event of the year, the Arab Spring. This reawakening of the Arab peoples has seen the overthrow of governments in Tunisia, in Egypt, in Libya, a transition in power in Yemen, serious challenges to the authority of governments in other parts of the region and what looks to be virtual civil war in Syria. It's still too early to tell how all this will turn out, but these are events that I suspect will have long-term geopolitical and possibly geo-economic implications. But what then of the global recovery in 2011? Well, we have to say it was dramatically undermined by a series of events emanating in the North Atlantic. To be frank, Europe spent 2011 lurching between economic catastrophe and mere disaster. The world watched morbidly fascinated as a fundamental mismatch between underlying competitiveness and fiscal policies dragged one Eurozone country after another into crisis. Recognising that the integration of global banking systems increasingly risked turning Europe's slow-motion train wreck into a global problem. And while we all knew that the US faced significant medium-term fiscal challenges, how many of us expected that the US would lurch to the brink of default over the simple decision to raise its debt cap? Or that this would result in the unprecedented loss of its AAA credit rating? So as a result of these factors and the inability or unwillingness of political institutions in the affected countries to craft effective responses, at the end of 2012, the mid-year economic and fiscal outlook describes a short-term global outlook as follows. Now, despite this change from MIUFO 2010-11 to MIUFO 2011-12, Australia remains among the best placed of the world's advanced economies to weather the fallout from these global developments. But we have been significantly affected, and we cannot expect to be immune if things deteriorate further. MIUFO saw our forecasts downgraded from budget, with economic growth lowered by 0.75 percentage point in 2011-12 and by 0.5 percentage point in 2012-13. We've seen forecast government revenue fall by some $20 billion over the 4 years of the forward estimates, meaning that in 2012-13 alone, our revenue forecasts are around $10 billion less than what we expected to collect in this year prior to the GFC. And at the same time, our economic growth is still likely to be around trend, underlying inflation's firmly in the middle of the RBA's target band, and unemployment remains close to the Nauru. Australian banks remain well placed to handle the ongoing funding pressures emanating from Europe, and our four major banks indeed remain amongst the most profitable and well capitalised in the world. And indeed, according to Standard & Poor's, there is only one bank rated globally that has a higher rating than the four Australian majors. So let's look forward. Most attention as we start this coming decade is devoted to the continuing fallout from the North Atlantic. So what does 2012 and beyond hold? Let's start with Europe then. In early 2011, ongoing concerns about Greece's debt led to fears of a disorderly Greek debt default and adversely impacted on confidence in the Eurozone region. Coupled with slippage, a euphemism for the fact that they failed to meet what they promised to deliver, slippage in the Greek IMF-EU programme in May 2011, this resulted in markets once again becoming highly stressed. These developments weighed on confidence and economic growth throughout the Eurozone region. In Greece, the need to meet targets agreed under the IMF-EU programme, despite dramatic falls in forecast GDP, led to ever more dramatic fiscal tightening. This vicious cycle was widely seen as unsustainable without further intervention. And indeed, the fate of Ireland and Greece was increasingly being projected onto other Eurozone countries as the year progressed. In mid-2011, EU leaders agreed to increase the effective size of the region's emergency bailout fund, the European Financial Stability Facility, to help combat the crisis. However, delays in its implementation, together with a lack of detail, on top of deteriorating growth prospects and fears of contagion through interlinked banking systems, resulted in significant market scepticism about whether the interventions would actually succeed. The result was pressure on credit ratings of the sovereigns that were underpinning the the Stability Fund, adding to greater uncertainty and to a further escalation of the crisis. As the year progressed, that is 2011, prospects in Europe continued to worsen and market confidence in political institutions' capacity to develop credible responses continued to decline. This manifested itself in different ways. In different ways in different countries. For example, the previous Italian government's perceived, quote, foot-dragging, unquote, when it came to implementing credible reforms, saw Italian bond spreads, that is, the gap between Italian bonds and the yield on German bonds, blow out remarkably to around 500 basis points, or 5%. And indeed, total Italian bond yields, that is the absolute level of interest that was being was required by holders of bonds, rose to 7.5%. Now, given Italy's sizeable debt, gross debt's around 120% of GDP, and its deteriorating economic prospects, this led to concerns that it would be very difficult for Italy to service its debt should yields remain at elevated levels. Put it another way, if GDP growth, real GDP growth, and inflation together are a lot less than the interest rate you're paying on your debt, and you've got high levels of debt, it calls into question the capacity of the country to continue to service that debt without adjustment. And that's exactly what we saw first around Spain and Italy and Portugal, and then increasingly questions began to be asked about the impact on this in the core Eurozone countries. The 26 October Leaders' Summit attempted to achieve three key objectives. First, to place Greek sovereign debt on a sustainable footing. To minimise contagion to the other Euro sovereigns by increasing the firepower of the EFSF. And third, to restore confidence in Europe's banking sector by increasing banks' capital requirements. However, markets still remain sceptical over these measures. In particular, questions remained over the details, implementation, and whether ultimately commitment existed to deal with the underlying problems associated with high sovereign debt and weak growth. Recall, what's happened in these countries is there's been a fundamental mismatch between the underlying competitiveness of the country and the fiscal policies that they've been attempting to pursue. You can't just deal with one of these. Europeans have to deal with both. Now, the recent announcement on 9 December of moves towards more fiscal integration is to be welcomed, but it repeats the same process that we've seen throughout the year. Little detail announced at the time, feeding into even more heightened market scepticism. Moreover, while the measures announced may be a good step forward in addressing medium to longer term issues, they are not perceived by markets as dealing with the immediate problems facing the region. And we saw evidence of that again last night. But before leaving Europe, let me return to Greece again and the vicious circle that I mentioned earlier. Historically, what's tended to occur is that in response to a crisis, the troubled sovereign implements even harsher austerity measures. Now, as this chart shows, each subsequent review of the Greek program has meant that, so on the right-hand set of bars, what it's showing you is that every time the program's been reviewed, there's been a downgrade in expectations about future economic growth. Now, every time that's occurred, that's led to a requirement of even greater fiscal consolidation. So as a result, what we've had is pro-cyclical policy. That is, we've had the economy slowing, that leading to inability to meet the targets that had previously been agreed in terms of fiscal consolidation, hence leading to more demands for fiscal consolidation, hence leading to even greater slowing of growth. Now, what this is showing you is that GDP growth now, over 2011 and 2012, is expected to be minus 8%. That is, over those 2 years, the economy is expected to shrink by around 8%. As a result of the commitments, though, that Greece has entered into, over the period 2010, 2011 and 2012, it has to do a cumulative fiscal consolidation of almost 25% of GDP. It's worth just thinking about what those numbers mean. So they have to consolidate the equivalent of a quarter of their economy over a three-year period. So what this is saying is that fiscal policy has been pro-cyclical and will be pro-cyclical unless there are other actions to boost growth. But that's not where the focus has been. Excuse me. Now, given the delays in crafting a euro-wide credible policy response and the fiscal contractions now underway in many eurozone members, Europe will almost certainly enter recession next year. The only issue is how deep it is and how long it is. And our assessment is that at the moment, if everything went well, it could be a shallow recession. If everything does not go well, it could be long, deep, and very drawn out. Now, everybody says that's been a bit gloomy there. So let me turn to the positive story, which is the United States. Compared to only 6 months ago, the US economic recovery is looking in far better shape. The first half of 2011 saw a US economy hit by a confluence of events that acted to seriously impede the growth of the world's largest economy. Poor weather in early 2011 depressed the tentative growth that was being seen in the construction sector, and that was followed on by the tsunami-driven supply chain effects stemming from Japan, which impacted on the US manufacturing sector and on US exports. Taken together, what this did is it meant that US growth was only 0.4% over the first 6 months of 2011. And in addition, downward revisions to US GDP growth meant that even by June quarter 2011, the US economy had still not completely recovered in terms of the level of GDP from the 2008-09 recession. Confidence in recovery was clearly not assisted by the congressional debt ceiling debate, which, as I said, took the US to the brink of default. Since then, however, the fortunes of the US economy have begun to recover. Consumer confidence has begun to rise, and domestic demand has contributed to a relatively robust growth rate in the September quarter of 0.5%. That said, this remains a very unusual recovery. Now, what this chart is showing you is it sets the level of GDP at 100 at the time of the start of the recession and plots out the fall and then recovery in GDP. So you can see the 1991 recession and the 1974-75 recessions. GDP growth, GDP's back to the level it was after about five quarters. In the 1980 to 82 recession, the so-called double dip recession, it recovers quickly in about four quarters. It grows strongly. Then you go into the second recession at about the eighth quarter, and it bounces along, still at around the same level of GDP as prior to the recession for another three or four quarters. Look at the 2008-09 line. It's taken 13 quarters for GDP to get back to where it was beforehand. And the US labour market remains anemic. Again, this does the same thing. It shows you for different recessions how quickly the labour market has rebounded. And look at the line closest to the horizontal axis, the January 2008 to now line. What's basically saying is that US employment growth is still almost 5 percentage points below... US employment, not employment growth. US employment level is almost 5 percentage points below what it was at the start of the recession. The US housing market remains equally depressed, with an estimated excess supply of housing that would take around 8 months to clear at current sales rates, and persistently low house prices acting to weigh down new home construction. Now, look at this. Look at what's happened to US house prices. This 20-year average is now, the 20-city average is around 70% of what it was at the peak prior to the GFC. And in some places like Las Vegas, house prices on average are around 40% of what they were in April 2006. So the US is on a path to recovery, albeit a slow and tentative one. However, the US public balance sheet remains a work in progress. The failure of the Congressional Super Committee tasked with finding US $1.2 trillion in budget savings has now triggered automatic spending cuts. This could reduce GDP growth by up to 0.75 percentage point in financial year 2013, a potentially significant shock to what is likely to be then a still modest recovery. So let's come back to Australia. Developments in 2011 in the North Atlantic and going into 2012 clearly emphasise the importance of good public finances. They also highlight how critical it is that we have a focus on underlying competitiveness to generate sustainable growth, and that this requires credible medium-term macroeconomic policy frameworks and structural flexibility. As I noted earlier, developments globally have and will continue to have impacts on Australia. Perhaps the most marked impact has been on the budget, particularly through the write-down on the Commonwealth's revenue estimates. In total, revenue over the period 2008-09 to 12-13 is expected to be $141 billion less than we expected over that same period when we put the 2008-09 budget together, as a result of the GFC, the natural disasters, and now the growth effects of the European crisis. So this is showing you what we expected to be our revenue collections. Dotted line is at the time of the 2008-09 budget, and the blue line is what we've collected to date and what we anticipate in MIEFO. Now, while the impact of the GFC was less than initially feared, around $110 billion of that $141 billion downgrade can be directly explained by the global financial crisis. And over the past 18 months, natural disasters and the ongoing problems in Europe have led to an estimate of about $30 billion in revenue loss over the years to 12-13. Now, while our economy will recover in time, the revenue is permanently lost. And as a result, our debt's higher than what it would have otherwise been. Now, it's always what it would otherwise have been, assuming we'd done the same spending, but we got the revenues that we'd been anticipating. Now, this weaker domestic growth outlook also means that setting fiscal policy to be consistent with the government's medium-term fiscal strategy is going to continually involve hard decisions. Recall that the fiscal strategy includes achieving budget surpluses on average over the medium term and keeping tax as a share of GDP on average below the level that it was inherited in 2007-08. And I'll come back to that in a moment. Now, this weak outlook for revenues is expected to continue beyond the forward estimates, that is, beyond 2013-14. Indeed, we suspect that tax receipts will stay below 2007-08 levels as a share of GDP for most of this decade. The government's also committed to restrain annual real growth in spending to 2% on average until a surplus of over 1% of GDP is delivered. As the next chart shows, to achieve projected surpluses in the forward estimates period, so out to 14-15, spending as a share of the economy will have to be slightly lower on average than what it's been between 2001 and the start of the GFC. But just to put some numbers around this, if you look at the total receipts line, between 2007-2008, that's about 24, 25.4% of GDP. from 2008-09 to 2014-15, it's around 23% of GDP. So in other words, there's been, on average, a loss of about 1.4% of GDP. In outlays terms, 2001 to 2007-08, outlays were about 24.2% of GDP. From 08-09 to 14-15, they're projected to be about 24.5% of GDP. But all of that occurs in the period prior to 12-13. In 12-13, 13-14 and 14-15, all of those outlays shares have to be lower than the average prior to the GFC. So it just highlights again that the real challenge for us on the fiscal side is not the fact that outlays as a share of GDP have changed dramatically, but that it's our revenue base that's been eroded significantly. Now, I'm not saying anything about whether the outlay share is appropriate. I'm just saying that if you look at historically, where the impact has occurred has been on the revenue side. Now, while it's our own performance that ultimately matters, our fiscal indicators also suggest that we're well-placed compared to other advanced economies. The government's returning the budget to surplus ahead of the other major advanced economies. Our average net debt position is around 8.9%. It'll peak at around 8.9%. In contrast, we're expecting the G7 debt levels to peak at around 90% of GDP, so 10 times higher in 2016. But while our actual position is healthy, and markedly so in comparison with the countries that we tend historically to compare ourselves with, this is not a cause for complacency. We will need continued focus on the hard decisions to deliver the outcomes that are reflected in those charts I showed you, and to maintain our fiscal credibility and sustainable public finances. And while fiscal consolidation will remain a priority, we also need to continue to pursue an economic reform agenda which will assist the Australian economy adjust to global shocks and to generate a sustainable base from which to create and boost wealth and living standards over the next decade. This means tackling the decline in our productivity performance in order to expand our growth potential, to offset the impacts of ageing, and allow us to respond to the global transformation from west to east that is underway. And that's what I'll turn to now. So while 2011 saw multiple shocks to the global economy, and 2012 suggests that economic growth in Europe and North America is going to be non-existent in one case and weak in the other. In 2011, we also continue to witness a much more profound and longer-term transformation of the global economy. That is the rise of the emerging market economies, China, India, Brazil, South Africa, and indeed close to home, Indonesia and Vietnam. There's been considerable attention this year on the impacts of structural change in Australia arising from the global transformation, typically relating to the impacts of the higher exchange rate that are threatening the viability of business models, particularly in the manufacturing sector. But the exchange rate story is only one part of a broader structural adjustment process unfolding in our economy. While it may appear to some that this story of structural adjustment began in 2011, these changes have in fact simply been acceleration of trends that have been operating for some time. In 2006, my predecessor Ken Henry spoke publicly on several occasions about the impact of the re-emergence of China into the global economy and what that would mean for the structure of the Australian economy. A substantial demand for mineral commodities by China and other emerging economies leads to a terms of trade boom, that is the ratio of export prices to import prices, providing a price signal that reallocates resources towards the mining sector and away from import competing sectors, with the volume of trade expanding for both resource exports and imports of manufacturers. As was noted at the time, these were phenomena that would be expected to play out over decades, reshaping the Australian economy as it went. And as we all know now, these factors have indeed played out in just this manner over recent years. These developments led to much thinking about the appropriate policy frameworks and settings needed to respond to both the associated challenges and opportunities from the re-emergence or the emergence of China and India. and the other large developing economies. Now, themes of a flexible economy, promoting sustainable growth and boosting productivity are firmly part of that policy response. Flexible exchange rate is clearly important for macro stability, but also in spreading the benefits of the boom through lower prices for consumer goods and for intermediate and capital goods into Australian production processes. But more broadly, a more flexible economy helps allocate resources more effectively and can lead to better overall macro outcomes. Take the performance of the labour market. We've seen evidence that despite the geographic concentration of the mining boom, the dispersion of unemployment across the regions has actually narrowed over recent years. And we suspect this outcome owes much to efforts to improve labour flexibility over quite some period of time. Now, if you'll bear with me, I'm from Treasury and I'm a nerd. This is, to a bunch of Treasury economists, a really exciting set of charts. So there are 1,400 local statistical areas in Australia, and at any point in time, we can calculate the unemployment rate for those statistical areas. Then we can actually add up the number of statistical areas that actually have that unemployment rate and work out what that is as a share of all 1,400. That ratio gives you a share of the regions with any particular unemployment rate. And if you look at the spread of unemployment rates at any particular point in time, that gives you an estimate of the dispersion of unemployment rates, as well as telling you what the national average unemployment rate is. So, if we take September 1998, this is showing you that our unemployment rate is across the 1,400 areas, spreads out between just a little above zero through to close to the high teens. At the same time, we can calculate for September 98 the dispersion and the average. Now, we can do that for a range of other times, and the ones we've picked here just to illustrate this show that as time has gone on, the unemployment rate has fallen and those little curves have moved to the right. Now, why is that interesting? Well, that's just another example. Why it's interesting is this. So, the vertical axis has the measure of dispersion, and the horizontal axis has the average unemployment rate. So that September 98 example I showed you can be plotted there. Now, if the labour market was flexible and we were seeing that the concentration of activity in the mining sector was not leading to differences in performance in the labour market across the country, you would see, as we plot out these other numbers, these other dates, a reasonably straight line. If, on the other hand, the concentration in the mining sectors was leading to significant dispersions in unemployment, that is, some parts of the country were really falling behind, you would actually see this come down and then flatten out. And lo and behold, he says, and it doesn't work. So the reason why it went back up when it got right down the end was the GFC, and then it started to come back down again. And that chart is basically telling us, so to illustrate it again, if we were seeing big parts of the labour market being left behind, this would have begun to flatten out or maybe even rise. But in fact, that line is pretty much stable right through there. And we think that owes much to the efforts that have been made to improve the flexibility of the Australian labour market over quite a period of time. Now, coming back to China and India, I sort of raise this because China and India are behind the boost in demand for our natural resources, but the story is richer than that. But so too are the opportunities and challenges that confront Australia. As they seek to shift millions of their citizens out of poverty, becoming more urbanised, and to build the cities, infrastructure and amenities that we in the advanced economies take for granted, the emerging economy living standards will rise and the size of the middle classes will grow significantly. In 2009, there are around about 500 million middle class consumers in the Asia Pacific region, that is, excluding the United States. By 2020, it's expected this figure will increase to an astonishing 1.7 billion, so an increase of 1.2 billion over a decade. And by 2030, it'll rise to about 3.2 billion people. Now, this scenario eventuates. This region will have more middle-class consumers than the rest of the world combined by 2020, and China will be the world's single largest market in dollar terms for middle-class goods and services. Now, what that means is that the size of the Asian middle class expands and incomes rise, they'll exhibit consumption patterns more akin to advanced economies. This creates a massive potential market for our key knowledge-based exports, like education and high-end manufacturing, as well as for tourism. As living standards improve, purchasing power rises, and food consumption pattern changes, so we can expect to see a growing demand for agricultural and soft commodities as the new members of the middle class have greater opportunities for a more protein-rich diet. Now, no one should be under any illusion that this is preordained to benefit Australia. We'll have to pursue the right policies to benefit from this, and no one should be under any illusion that the growth paths of the emerging economies, whether China or any other country, will be smooth and uninterrupted. There will be cycles of growth, but we anticipate that these will be around a strong rising trend when looked at over periods of decades. In the case of China, a key test will be how the government manages the need for greater reliance on more market-like policy instruments and how it further integrates with the existing global economic architecture, or indeed reshapes that architecture. With the economic centre of gravity shifting with the re-emergence of Asia, there are consequential and quite profound implications for international geopolitical relationships, the result of which will be a more multipolar distribution of influence. This means Australia will need to operate in a global and regional environment where leading powers have very different political systems and operating assumptions, with few current signs of convergence and differing views on the provision of public goods such as economic stability and environmental outcomes. Moreover, Australia will be operating in a historically unique environment where its primary economic and security relationships do not coincide. While the growth of China, India and other emerging economies will continue the diffusion of global influence that we've seen over the last decade, the major developed economies, including the US, Japan and Europe, will continue to have a strong influence on the global economy through their technological leadership, their contribution to growth, albeit weak, accumulated wealth and prominence in world financial markets. However, the structural weaknesses in those economies, in the form of the significant financial and fiscal imbalances I talked about earlier, and in parts of Europe, the weak international competitiveness I mentioned, will take many years to play out. So much of the next decade is likely to be characterised, therefore, by slow rates of growth in the key developed economies, with additional macroeconomic volatility arising from what has traditionally been thought of as the more stable part of the world economy. In this world of weaker growth of the advanced economies, the importance of the emerging economies rises even further and faster. But because China has grown so quickly, it has not yet really found its feet as the world's second largest economy, and is not really sure what sort of leader it should be. The rise of Asia, and in particular the China story, brings with it a number of complexities which are equally as important to comprehend as the opportunities I've discussed earlier. And highlighting this point, the Prime Minister recently commissioned a white paper on Australia in the Asian Century, led by Dr. Ken Henry. Understanding the growth and change in Asia will have immense global as well as regional implications, and will be important for Australia and Australians, whether in government or in business or in the community more broadly, to take a broad perspective on what this all means for us and how we can prepare ourselves to reap the benefits and manage the risks. To conclude then, we've seen a number of significant events, some still unfolding, which were largely inconceivable at this time last year. And other long-lived transformations have, if anything, accelerated even further. Given the near-term global outlook remains uncertain, were I to be here this time next year, I might find myself saying the same thing that I've said already, but at least I could say that I predicted I'd be saying something along those lines. The Australian economy has not been immune from these events. We can take some comfort from our starting position. We are located in the fastest growing part of the world economy. We have huge opportunities which are likely to present themselves over the next decade. And equally, the flexibility of our economy and our medium term oriented policy frameworks have assisted us in managing the impacts of external volatility now over a period of 30 odd years. These policies have stood us in good stead in the current volatility, and they'll provide a good foundation for the policies that we need to pursue to reap the opportunities and prospect over the decade ahead and beyond. Thank you very much.
Many thanks, Dr. Parkinson. So we come to questions and discussion. As usual, I'll be calling our members in a minute. But before I do like to say thanks to Clayton Yutz for the use of this fine facility, which is a great facility, and we're very grateful that they provide it to us on occasion. So we'll come to questions and discussion. Finish no later than 7 o'clock. Martin Parkinson will come back here and just talk to the end of the room as usual. Just leading off, as I recall, I think it was a Senate hearing earlier this year, you spoke about the difficulties of predicting revenue, and you were talking about the early 2000s at a time of pretty well a boom, and you made the point how difficult it was in the period of the Howard Costello government to sort of calculate it. In the current climate, you've pointed out a volatility and particularly you talk about a likelihood of a recession in Europe. Does this make the task of assessing revenue more difficult, or is it always difficult, or has the degree of difficulty increased?
It's always difficult, but I think in terms of trade shock on the way up, so the period of the 2003 to 2007 I was talking about in the Senate hearing, I was making the point that we constantly underestimated the revenue. And in a sense, we beat ourselves up a lot because we kept thinking, are there mistakes in the way we're thinking about revenue estimation? Are there things we're missing that are happening in the economy? And in fact, it was the sheer magnitude of the China boom. Caught everybody by surprise. It caught us by surprise. It caught the mining companies by surprise. It caught the Chinese by surprise. But in a sense, there was an asymmetry that wasn't a bad one to have, because you were surprised by too much revenue, even though it did come at what I think is a fairly significant cost, which is one wonders whether a government, knowing it would have got much greater revenues over a number of years, would have been more prepared to pursue ambitious reform agendas. In the period ahead, and the period we've just been through, what we've got is much, much greater uncertainty about the revenue numbers. And even on the forecast that we have, it is very, very hard to get back to surplus and then to build the surpluses over time, which is what you would hope to see. So I think we are going to find ourselves in a situation where revenues can be very difficult to forecast for some time. And this reflects a number of factors. One is the huge loss of asset values caused by the GFC. So that means that capital gains tax collections are going to be dampened for a very long period of time. The second is accumulated losses in the corporate sector through the GFC. We don't know when corporates will actually wash those losses out of the system. And the third factor is that, somewhat ironically, this massive boom that we have in investment actually costs revenue relative to what would have been the case otherwise, because so much of that mining investment comes with very big depreciation deductions, very big offsets to revenue up front. Now, once all of that flows through and they're in a production stage, and they've depreciated their capital investments, the world becomes a different picture. But that's not something we're likely to see over the next half decade or a decade. So for that reason, we think the outlook for revenue is going to be very subdued, and at the same time, what's happening globally is going to make our capacity to forecast it quite difficult.
I noticed that you pointed out that lovely add-on graph that as we made our labour market much more flexible, which has been the battle of the last two decades, our unemployment rates have gone down.
Mm-hmm.
What happens if we tighten it up, go back to a regulated industrial relations system, which we're doing right now, do we then affect our unemployment rates?
Look, I think the... I'm not going to buy into the debate about labour market at the moment, other than to say there are a lot of claims at the moment, and it's difficult to find a lot of macroeconomic level evidence of anything happening. But clearly, were we to take the extreme step of going back to the centralised wage fixing system and the rigidities that we had in the labour market in the 70s and the first part of the 80s, then you would expect over time to see unemployment ratchet up. Remember that how we ended up with high unemployment was that we got these shocks, external shocks that hit the economy right through the 70s. We had centralised wage fixing, and we were trying to keep the exchange rate fixed, and every shock we got ratcheted the unemployment rate up, and it didn't come down. And next shock, ratcheted up. And the policies that were pursued in the 80s and 90s and subsequently of what have delivered for us these massive improvements in our unemployment performance. And it's not just the reduction in the average unemployment rate across the economy, it's that decrease in the dispersion, which is really important, because historically you would see unemployment rates in the cities come down and in the regional areas hold up much higher. You still get a bit of that, but that's closed up dramatically.
So there's a question here.
I don't know nothing about economics, but it seems to me that you get a middle class from the productivity of the society. And I'm just looking at the Middle East over there, where it seems to me the Middle East, how can you visualise it having lots of industries? Its economies are going to go down because revenues will be diminishing. You know, do you see all these people suddenly getting industrial revolutions and getting a number of middle class, which have to come from the other sector, doesn't society? You know, the productive sector. The business sector, the working sector, the people who make things.
The people who make things. So apparently, Clayton Utz, I'm sorry, but you're not part of the productive society. Is that what you're saying? No, I don't think you are.
No.
But look, there is GDP growth and rising living standards have different drivers at different stages of economic development. Very, very poor countries, it comes from agriculture, then they industrialise, then they move into services. So a country like ours, three-quarters of our GDP comes from services. Over time, you'll see, even in the Middle East, there are considerable efforts to expand and diversify the industrial base in those countries. And some of those countries, small but highly successful, the Emirates, for example, others, like some of the countries such as Egypt, don't have significant fossil fuel bases. If they're going to continue to develop, they have to develop in a more balanced way, emphasis on manufacturing, emphasis on tourism, emphasis on developing services. And you see that in many of these countries. I'm not an expert in the Middle East, far from it. Is this likely to happen? I don't know. I hope. In fact, I hope they do a darn sight better, because the more we can get those bars to grow in every area, the more we're lifting people around the world out of poverty. And that's an unambiguously good thing.
Thank you.
and it also provides more opportunities for Clayton Newtons.
John?
Under the scenario provided for the next couple of years, it looked as though we're in for a lot more volatility. In that situation, seeing that mortgage rates are probably below historic averages, wouldn't it be best for banks to take out a bit of insurance and give more of their potential profits or whatever to people who provide deposits for them so they can manage particular problems that might arise if things freeze up?
This is where I do the Tony James and say I'm going to take that as a comment, not a question. Look, you know, banks will do whatever banks do. The important thing is that we have a competitive banking system, and that they are driven by competitive pressures to deliver the services and the rates that the public is expecting of them. Our banking system is relatively concentrated, and it's not the role of the Reserve Bank or any other part of government to guarantee the profits of the banking system. The banks have to get out there and compete, and that's essentially what the Treasurer has been saying. If you don't like your bank, move. There are people out there, are institutions out there that will offer lower rates, and by all means, take the opportunity to pursue them.
Now, we're running out of time, so we're going to go Craig, Rory, and then behind Rory. We've got to be quick. Yeah, Craig.
I'm just trying to get a bit about your shallow versus long, deep, gloomy outcome. And shallow outcome is if everything goes according to plan, and long, deep, gloomy if it doesn't. How the forward economic estimates, which scenario has been built in?
Look, we have to go with what we think is the most likely outcome, and that is continuing to muddle along, gradually get clarity around this. We end up with a muted recession, a mild recession in the next 12 months, and then weak growth thereafter. And that's spelled out in my EFO. But at the same time, we spend a lot of time in my EFO spelling out the downside risks and saying that those downside risks are a real threat.
Rory.
Norman Parkinson, a question about public debt and the rating agencies. So you mentioned Australia has been, is likely to have net debt peak around 9% of GDP versus the G7 average, I think, of 90%. In the Eurozone, where the sort of the public debt crisis is most intense at the moment, a country like France, Poland was supposed to keep public debt under 60% of GDP, and as they went from 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90, the rating agencies didn't say boo in most cases. And so now we're you're on the crux of at the edge of the precipice sort of thing. So the rating agencies weren't a break on these countries going from 60 to 70 to 80, and so now you've got AAA countries, say France, 90% of GDP, I think their debt level is. They're AAA, but having not been a break on the process, S&P and Moody's in the recent week have basically threatened the obvious downgrade of France, basically throwing fuel on the fire. So my question is, are rating agencies just as hopeless as everyone else for not anticipating how things are going to play out, or do they deserve special criticism since they were supposed to be the break on the process?
Look, I'm not going to say. I'm not going to single out anyone for special criticism, people are guided by the rating agencies. The rating agencies have had some tensions in their business models, I think, in terms of some of the things that they've done over time. I think what we're seeing in a number of instances is the rating agencies trying to overcompensate now for some of the things that they've done in the past. What worries me is that what they're starting to do now is mechanistic and excessively simplistic. And so you, um, you run the risk of moving from excessive optimism every time you look at a country or you look at a firm to excessive pessimism because you've got a small number of checklist indicators and you bang through it and you move on to the next one and you never really understand the circumstances. So I always think we've got to be very careful about relying on any single indicator, and that includes the rating of a firm.
Question.
Yep.
Dr. Parkinson, Philip Nutter. Just wondering, how worried are you with the recent Chinese reserve ratio requirement being lowered by 50 basis points, which is a clear signal to the world that China's slowing down a hell of a lot than anyone's anticipating? That's the first question. The second question would be, if you look at what Treasury Secretary Geithner did in the States with talking the US dollar down, which has been probably the main reason for their sudden competitiveness and the increases in car sales, etc. Who have we got in our country that can do that? Because, and where do you see the Aussie dollar parity or the Aussie dollar coming in the next sort of couple of years to get us competitive again?
I think you might take the second one as a comment.
I think I'll take the second one as a comment. In fact, I was so taken by the second one, I can't even remember what the first one was.
About China.
It was China. I was up in China just a couple of weeks ago. It was pretty clear that Chinese inflation has peaked, the economy is slowing, the authorities do not expect a hard landing. Virtually none of the private sector people I spoke to, either in China or outside China, were of that view. In fact, if anything, it was being seen as it would be appropriate to start to ease off on monetary policy. And that's essentially what's happened in China. So I'm not worried about it. I think it's actually not part of the normal policy cycle that the Chinese were attempting to pursue. And indeed, the more that we can get them to start to use the proper instruments of monetary policy rather than directed lending to control their economy, the better it will all be, and they will be over time. So I think it's a good news story.
You don't want to take up the mantle of Treasury Secretary Geithner on the other
side? Look, I'll be completely open to you. I mean, I think anybody who thinks that you talk down a dollar or you talk it up a dollar is a fool. I mean, it's just ridiculous. I mean, what drives the Australian dollar? It's actually the terms of trade, interest differentials, a range of different things. But what's driven the Australian dollar up is the rise in Australian terms of trade. If you want to get a lower dollar, given what the world... So the way to think about this, right, the world is trying to give us a massive amount of wealth that we didn't have yesterday morning. If you try and lower the dollar, what you're really saying is, I'm going to take part of that wealth, I'm going to put it over here and pour petrol on it, I'm going to burn it. If you want to be living in that world, that's fine. But I don't think it's a world that's actually very sensible for the long-term living standards of Australian people. So I think a floating exchange rate brings with it massive benefits, occasionally it causes some dislocation for parts of the economy. But it's not the dollar that's doing it; it's actually the emergence of China and India and the other economies that are leading to higher terms of trade in Australia.
I think we're pretty well concluded. We're right on 7 o'clock, so it's a nice place to stop. And you didn't try and talk the dollar up or the dollar down, so there you go. It's a great honour to have Dr. Parkinson at the Sydney Institute. He's not only been a commentator today on the world economy, but an Australian economy, but of course he's also been a significant player. And one of the reasons why the Australian economy has done so well over so many recent years is because we've had people of the calibre of Dr. Parkinson in Canberra influencing policy. So it's great that you come along today, share your views about the Australian economy, about the world economy, and it's hard to find a more interesting time for you to be here in view of the great discussions about Europe and beyond. So well done tonight, and thanks, and hope to see you back again in the future. Thanks.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.